You're listening to a special New Living Expo edition of Life Insights Live with Scout Bartlett. Oh, I like that. I don't even know why. That's right. You are listening to a special New Living Expo edition of Life Insights Live with Scout-like Pathfinder and Bartlett-like Pears. We'll be bringing you an interview from one of the workshops at the New Living Expo that's coming up here right at the end of the month. That's right, we do have the New Living Expo coming up here in San Francisco. It's the last weekend of April, Friday evening, Saturday, and Sunday. KEST will have their own booth there. I'll be in the booth. You can look for me with my purple beard and my little naked head. But more to the point, there's a series of workshops with internationally known figures. And our guest today is a remarkable individual for us to get to talk to. This is John Perkins. He's the author of the Economic Hitman series of books, and his original book, Road: Confessions of an Economic Hitman, rode on the bestsellers list for over a year. It was there forever. John is explaining that the fat cats, the CEOs that are running the corporatoxity, I can't say that one, I'll have him fix that for me, have created predatory capitalism. I couldn't agree with him more. A misguided form of geopolitics and capitalism that has encouraged exploiting all of the little people for the few that are trying to run the world. The most important part, though, John says there is a way out. It says he was inspired by the birth of his grandson, wrote Hoodwinks initially to get this information out to people, and now is bringing out his latest book, Hoodwinked, An Economic Hitman Reveals Why the Global Economy Imploded, bringing that one forward specifically so the few of us, a critical mass, a tiny percentage of the population, can consciously take action. A strategy for implementing change encompassing five primary arenas. So everybody, this is John. John, this is everybody. Welcome.
Thank you, Scout. It's great to be here with you today and with all of you out there.
All right, so how did it come about? Well, first of all, let me ask the simple question. What on earth is an economic hitman?
Well, you know, I think it's fair to say, Scout, that we economic hitmen have managed to create the world's first truly global empire. And it's the first empire in history that's been created primarily without the military, through economics. We work in many different ways, but I think the most common is that I would go in, and economic hitmen go in, into countries that have a country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, for example, arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters, but the money doesn't ever actually go to the country at all. Instead, it goes to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, industrial parks, things that benefit a few wealthy families in the country, as well as our own corporations that are the main beneficiaries, but do not help the majority of the people who are too poor to buy electricity, can't get jobs in industrial parks because they don't hire many people, and yet they are left holding a huge debt, one that they can't repay. So at some point we go back and say, hey, since you can't pay your debts, sell your oil or whatever the resource is very cheap to our corporations without any social limitations, without having to pay insurance or health care, without taking care of the environment, or allow us to build a military base on your soil, these kinds of things, empire building, really a very subtle form of empire building. And in the few cases when we fail, when the leaders of these countries do not buy the deals that we're proposing, the jackals step in. These are people that either overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. And I had personal experience in Ecuador with Jaime Roldós, who would not accept this condition. He had too much integrity. And Omar Torrijos in Panama, both of whom I worked with and tried to bring them around, they would not come around. They were both assassinated by CIA-supported jackals. And in that way, we've really built this empire in a very subtle way, and most Americans have no idea that it's going on.
That's a pretty strong statement, John. I know in some of the things I've gotten to read about you, it talks about your courage in writing the books and speaking out against your former bosses. And it talks about, like, the early founding fathers and everyone along the way, that you've had to actually stand up to threats and bribes in order to stay true to what your course is. Do I even want to ask that question?
Yeah, I didn't always do too good at it either, Scout. I'm sorry to admit. Back in the early 80s, when I stopped being an economic hitman, I started to write the book, and I contacted a lot of other economic hitmen and jackals, and then I began to receive threats, anonymous phone calls threatening my life and my daughter's life. She was just an infant at the time. Mm. At the same time, the chairman of the board of Stone & Webster, a big consulting firm in Boston and New York, took me out to dinner one night, and he said, "Hey, you know, you've got a great resume." I did. Officially, my title was chief economist
right.
at one of his rival corporations. I had a staff of several dozen people working for me. And he said, "You have a great resume. We'd like to use it in proposals, and we'd like to pay you $500,000 in a consultant's retainer. Just don't write the book we understand you're working on." And I have to say that back then in the early 80s, I had this young daughter. My life was threatened. Her life was threatened. I took the bribe. It was a legal bribe. There's nothing
right.
illegal about what he did.
Right.
But it was very obvious. He said, "You won't have to do any work for us. Just let us use your resume." And in my own defense, I have to say I used a lot of the money to help some of the indigenous people and other people in some of these countries that we were screwing. I used the money to form nonprofits. One of them became Pachamama Alliance, that many people in the Bay Area know about.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't write the book.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and then
I mean
the
that,
story
that
goes,
is a that
do
is
you
a,
want me to continue or is well, that enough for now?
That is a key element, John, and I want to make sure people are aware of this, that you did have a title of chief economist at a major international consulting firm. You advised and worked with people at the level of World Bank, United Nations, the IMF, International Monetary Fund, the Treasury Department, all the way across and on multiple continents. I mean, you had a background. You were in the middle of that side of the game. To the point that you said there was threats, it's funny, we live outside of that, but I think in the background we know that some of those parts of novels and movies about, well, here, we'll give you the contract, we'll pay you the money, you don't actually have to do anything, just don't do what we don't want you to do. How did you manage to, I'll just say, see the light and decide to step forward to form Dream Change and the Pachamama Alliance out of that?
Well, so I've accepted this bribe from Stone & Webster, and I then traveled a lot to, I had a lot of time on my hands. I traveled to countries. I'd been a Peace Corps volunteer in the Amazon before I ever became an economic hitman. I went back there. I worked with these indigenous people, and I put the money toward these things that I loved. And then I ended up writing 5 books, Shapeshifting, The World Is As You Dream It, Psychonavigation, books about my experiences with the indigenous people. And Stone & Webster was fine with that. They just didn't want me writing about my experiences as an economic hitman.
Right.
So I had 5 books published, and I was doing workshops at places like Esalen and Omega, and I still do those workshops. And incidentally, people can go to johnperkins.org and find out where I'm at.
Great.
So, but then 9/11 hit, and I was in the Amazon on 9/11 with a group of people that I'd taken down to train with and learn with some of the Amazonian people, like the Pachamama people. And but when I came home, I flew up to Ground Zero, and as I stood there looking into that still smoldering pit, I knew I had to write the book. I had to expose the truth of what's going on and what my country was doing in the world. And this isn't to condone what happened there at all, but it is to say I knew I had to speak my piece.
Yes.
And I knew that by then the ropes, what you do is you submit a proposal to a publisher, you get an advance, you write a book. I had 5 books published, but I didn't do any of that. This time I didn't tell a soul I was writing the book. Even my wife and daughter didn't know what I was writing about. But I wrote the whole book, not a proposal. I wrote the whole book. And once the manuscript was complete, I got it in the hands of a very good New York agent. He sent it out to publishers, and at that moment, it became my best insurance policy, and it still is, because any self-respecting jackal knows that if something dire happens to me, or it happened to me then, or it should happen to me now, sales of the book will skyrocket even more than they already have.
Yeah, it's
true.
I'll
become a martyr, and, you know, and that's the last thing they want.
So that's the book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. That was that one.
Right.
And then Hoodwinked, your latest book, is following up on that to take it one step even further, even with a full set of strategies for implementing change from where we occupy the planet, effectively.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When I wrote Confessions, I figured that was the end of my consulting career. That was, you know, that would put me on the blacklist. But it's very interesting that it's done the opposite over time. It did to begin with. But now, I just came back from Istanbul last 2 weeks ago, where I was speaking to a convention of business executives, very high-powered international CEOs. I travel around. I speak at Wharton and Stanford and business schools around the country and in China and Latin America. It's been very, very interesting to me that people are getting it, that this world that we've created is a failure. The economic system globally is a failure, and we have to change it. And the business school students are getting it. They know that they want to have children someday, and they want to have the kids grow up in a world that's not such a failure. This one is a failure. And so I've been invited to do this. And Random House, a couple of years ago, asked me, contracted with me to write the book Hoodwinked, which they asked me to write a book to really get at the root causes of the economic collapse,
mm-hmm.
not just the Band-Aid things, you know, not just the little bruises on the surface like the Glass-Steagall Act and things like that, which are important. You know, when you're bleeding, you need Band-Aids. But they said,
right.
We want to get at the root cause of what's wrong, and how can we fix that? So that's why Hoodwinked was written.
Oh, fabulous. That's excellent. Because there is, it's interesting, we have a similar phrase. One training that I teach, I talk about individuals developing a new normal. And that's one of the comments that you really drive home, is that we're not looking to have the economy gradually recover to get back to the normal we were at, that you've labeled very ideally and accurately as predatory capitalism, that we're not wanting to get back to that normal. There's a new normal that needs to happen to revolt against that mutated capitalism.
Exactly right, Scott. That's, yeah, that hits it. You know, the economy we have today is based on killing people to a very large degree. Let's face it, the U.S. economy is extremely militarized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based on producing things that pollute the earth. It's based on things that provide wealthy people with more and more needless luxuries. And yet at the same time, so where we've come to is a situation where less than 5% of us live in the United States, and we consume more than 25% of the world's resources. And as we all know, 1% of that 5% controls the vast majority of these, while roughly half the world is starving or on the verge of starvation. Now, you can only define that as a failed system.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a model. You know, China can't replicate it. India can't replicate it. Latin America can't replicate it. They may want to, but they can't. There's simply not enough resources for that to happen. So we've got to admit that we've created a failure, and now it's time to turn it around to create something much better for ourselves and our children and grandchildren.
You know, John, you're the first person that I've been able to talk to personally that's the fun part of doing these interviews. I get to ask the questions I want to ask. And this is the one that totally puzzles me. I am clairsentient, empathic. I can sense the people around me. I have a deep awareness of my effect on people around me. I've tried and I've tried and I've tried. I cannot actually fathom the motivations of, I'll just use the popular phrase, the big boys. You know, that half a dozen or so, mostly men, that are up there trying to grab everything and be in control of everything. Because they're too rich to be able to spend it all. They're too rich to even know where to invest it all. Have you got any guess what the heck actually drives these people?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things. One is entitlement. They've reached the stage where they feel totally entitled. And two, in our schools, our law schools and our business schools, we're taught that this is the measure. So if you're the CEO of a Fortune 500 company and you're making $20 million a year, and the CEO of a rival company is making $25 million, you're upset. You want to make more than him because that proves that you're better than he is.
Mm-hmm.
It's this proof thing. It's a little bit, you know, it's like the sports mentality. You know, a quarterback's winning the game 27-3, but is he going to start throwing away the ball, giving it to the other side so they can kind of have a few touchdowns of their own? No. He's going to try to get more and more touchdowns so it can go on his record that he can show that he scored so many touchdowns during the year. And I think we've got that mentality that we measure our success in quantitative terms, and for business executives, it's measured in terms of how much more money they make, how big is their mansion, how many cars do they own, how many mansions do they own. Rock stars do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very sad measurement, and we need to turn that around.
Yeah, I noticed that transition in American, and I'm not as globally educated, but I noticed it in America where CEOs actually went from being proud of how many people they employed. At one time, that was the measure. How many people we employed, how well employed are they, how well do they live? And instead, it got turned around to, well, you laid off 100,000 employees, then I need to lay off 150,000 employees to show that I'm CEO-ing better than you are.
Well, you hit the nail on the head, Scout. I tell you, when I went to business school in the late 60s, I was taught something very different from what they're taught now. I was taught that a good CEO... Hello, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, there's a strange noise. I was taught that a good CEO makes a decent rate of return for his investors, because that's the only way you can have investors. Makes a decent profit. But mm-hmm. In addition to that, a good CEO also provides really good health insurance for his employees, pension funds for retirement, takes good care of his employees and his customers and his suppliers, and also is a good community citizen, pays taxes willingly, goes beyond that, contributes money to recreation centers for young people and schools, etc. That was in the late 60s. And all that changed when Milton Friedman and the Chicago School of Economics came along and said, none of that matters. All that matters is that a good CEO needs to maximize profits, regardless of social and environmental costs, regardless of everything else, just maximize profits.
Right.
And that was the beginning of this, what we call the predatory capitalism. Totally greedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's resulted in a world that just is not functioning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's wild. We're going to break away for just a second, John, because I want to let us take it out to an ad spot now, Kwong, to let everybody know about the New Living Expo.
The annual New Living Expo returns to the Concourse in San Francisco, April 27th through the 29th. Celebrating 11 years of exploring better choices and new directions, the Expo returns with hundreds of exhibitors, respected speakers, and premier special events featuring Greg Braden, John Gray, and John Perkins. Enjoy a lively, interactive, and stimulating environment where new ideas blossom, relationships take root, and all are bathed in the sweet realm of infinite possibility. Hear the wisdom of teachers like Don Jose Ruiz, Terry Cole Whitaker, Lisa Nichols, and Carolyn Casey. Eat, play, listen. Visit the New Living Expo at the Concourse Exhibition Center in San Francisco. Details and the program guide are online at newlivingexpo.com or call 415-382-8300. Sponsors include KEST Radio, KPIX 5, SF Weekly, KFOG, and KPFA.
And we're back. You're listening to a special edition of Life Insights Live with Scout Bartlett. This is our special New Living Expo edition. We're talking with John Perkins. John has just brought out his new book, Hoodwinked. It's an economic hitman. You may have seen, in fact, you've undoubtedly seen, whether you read it or not, you've seen it everywhere, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. You can get more information about John at John Perkins, P-E-R-K-I-N-S, johnperkins.org or dreamchange.org. And one of the interesting parts about John is he's got a background all the way across the economy, yet one of the first books he published was Shape-Shifting, The World Is As You Dream It. So, John, we're primarily with Life Insights. We are about insights into life. Most of our programming is personal development. I want to jump across for a second. Tell me a little bit more about shape-shifting, because truthfully, I hadn't even realized that that was you.
Well, Scout, yeah, a lot of people don't associate the two, but my training in shamanism, which goes back to 1968 when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Amazon and I was dying of a very bad illness there.
Mm.
A shaman saved my life, a Shwa shaman at the Amazon, and as a result, he asked me to become his apprentice. That was my payment to him.
Wow.
I did, and really got into shamanism, and I'm dedicated to it, you know, since then. And one of the things that shamanism teaches us is that the world is as we dream it, that if we have a vision, a dream, an aspiration, a higher purpose, and we give it energy, it will manifest. And the shamans have told us that, you know, you guys in the North have had this dream of heavy materialism, of big industry and tall buildings and lots of cars. It's come true because you gave it energy.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're seeing that it's a nightmare. And so the way to change that is to change the dream. Give energy to a new dream, a dream of a sustainable, just, peaceful world, and one where all sentient beings can thrive. And so...
You just gave me chills, John. That was exquisite.
Well, thanks. Gives me chills every time I think about it or say it. And that's what we're doing. You know, we're seeing this happening, Scott. We're, you know, the Occupy movement, as I said, I just came back from the Middle East where it's amazing things are happening. And they're happening in South America. The Russians are standing up to Putin. It's happening in China where I was recently. It's happening all over. People really are waking up. And we need to keep helping them wake up. And beyond waking up, then, the next step is to really direct our energies to taking action. If we're angry, if we're mad, if we're frustrated with the current system, we can choose to use those emotions, the anger, the frustration, in many ways. I used to use anger at the system in destructive and even self-destructive ways. But what we need to do is learn to have fun with it, use it creatively, with shows like yours, do what you're doing. I direct a lot of my anger to my writing and my speaking, and I have fun with it. It's, you know, it's, I'm still angry, but I'm having fun with it. I'm using it in to take actions that I believe are very effective, and I think we can all learn a lesson from that. We're at an amazing time in human history,
mm-hmm.
a time that's been forecast by so many indigenous cultures, the Maya, the Quechua, the Tibetans. So many cultures around the world have said this is the time for change, and it's happening.
Absolutely. And that's a portion of, I love the name of it, of the nonprofit that you founded, Dream Change. The Pachamama Alliance is actually based here in the Bay Area. I know you travel the world, but I did find that interesting. I want to jump back just a little bit, John, because one of the comments you made was that when you first published Confessions of an Economic Hitman, you figured that was the end of your consulting. And instead, you're finding that you are actually more in demand, speaking to universities. And there's even notes in here that tell me that you've become required reading in a number of the business schools for people to actually grasp. I mean, I find it inspirational to think that the business schools are actually looking at the model, seeing that it's not working, and looking for how it needs to be adjusted to change the dream.
I find that fascinating too, Scout, and I'm very happy that it's happened. I never expected it. Confessions of an Economic Hitman, that manuscript that went out was rejected by 30 publishing houses.
Oof.
And
that had to
mainly
hurt.
Because they were afraid of, you know, it hurt to get all these rejection slips.
Yeah.
It was terrible. But they rejected it primarily because they were afraid of the politics. Editors didn't want to be associated with what they thought was radical politics. And then a very brave firm in San Francisco, Barrett Kohler, took it on. And it immediately went to the top of the charts and went on the New York Times bestseller list, stayed there for about a year and a half.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all the major publishers wanted the paperback rights. Penguin bought them from Barrett Kohler and so on and so forth.
Which is funny because that's that same economic model. Now that we know that it'll make us money, we want it.
Right, right. And also, you know, when they knew that the author had been vetted, the New York Times vetted me and came to the conclusion that everything I said was accurate.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of what they were afraid of, is that they had come up with some author who was not, you know, not telling
right.
the truth.
Right.
And so that gave them confidence, all these things. But what I'm finding is that business professors are coming to me and talking to me and asking me to teach at their classes and give lectures at their schools to the whole school and et cetera, because they're saying, you know what, the system you talk about is truly there. And nobody's really talked about it. It has been written up in the textbooks, but there it is. You're writing it from a guy who's had first-hand experience, and our students need to know about this. And I mm-hmm. find that the students themselves are very fascinated by this. And I think they're also fascinated by the idea that I'm not negative. I'm saying this is a bad system, and we have the opportunity to change it. There's a tremendous route here for changing it. This system is run by big corporations, not by politics. The politicians are controlled by the big corporations. I go into
right.
that in a lot of detail. And ultimately, we control the corporations. The corporations are us. We work for them. We buy from them. And we have an incredible history in the United States of turning corporations around, boycotting corporations that supported apartheid in South Africa, ending apartheid, getting them to clean up terribly polluted rivers, getting them to open their doors wider to women and minorities. We know that we have tremendous power over these corporations. They are us. And so now it's time to really start exercising that power.
Fabulous.
And I see us doing it. I see us doing it. I'm very, very hopeful and very excited about these times, frankly.
That's one of the pieces I love in Hoodwinked is while it's talking about a really dire world that we try to stay asleep and pretend we don't live in, it's talking about it from let's grab the steering wheel. And I know you're going to cover these at your workshop at the New Living Expo, John, but there's one that I really thought we could touch today. today. You've got six primary, I'll call them strategies, but the one that I think we can touch for a moment right here, we've got just, oh man, I am having such a good time. We've only got a few minutes left. Accepting consumer responsibility. Be willing to pay a little bit more for products that are made by companies that are socially and environmentally responsible is actually an investment in your future and the world's future.
Yes, I think that's so important. The marketplace is a democracy, if we choose to make it such. So every time we buy something or decide not to, we're casting a vote. And I actually think it's a more important vote than the one we cast every 2 or 4 years, because the businesses control our politicians. So we need to be really aware of that. And, yeah, the only reason that environmentally and socially good products cost more is because there aren't as many of them out there,
right,
and because we haven't factored in some of the what we call external costs into the price of these goods. But if we do have to pay a little more for them, we should recognize that that's not a sacrifice. It's an investment in the future, in our kids' futures. And if we cannot make that investment, if we absolutely can't afford that extra price, if there is an extra price, we should at least be aware that we've foregone an investment opportunity and make a commitment that when we can afford to do it, we will do it. But at least to be aware and to send emails to these corporations to tell them that we want to support the ones that are committed to, yeah, they can make profits, but not that new model of maximizing profits regardless of social and environmental costs. The new model has to be, and the only companies we're going to buy from is the ones that can make a profit, pay these in return to their investors, but only while being socially and environmentally responsible, while creating a sustainable, just, peaceful, and thriving world.
You
that
know,
has to be the guideline.
There's such a truth that my GPS can't tell me where I'm going till it knows where I am. It can't tell me how to get there till it knows where I am. And John, with Hoodwinked and with Confessions of an Economic Hitman, but also with Shapeshifters, you're bringing out a very strong reality of, okay, this is where we are, and here's some navigation on how we could move forward. I find it inspirational. I will make a point to be at your workshop at the New Living Expo so that you can sign my copy of Hoodwinked, because, you know, I might as well get that signature, and then it'll be worth more later. But we've been talking with John Perkins. This is Scout Bartlett with a special New Living Expo edition of Life Insights Live. You can find out more about John Perkins at johnperkins.org or dreamchange.org, or donate to Pachamama Alliance when you see it here. But most of all, grab the chance to experience John in person at the New Living Expo here in San Francisco. John, it's a real privilege. I'll look forward to actually getting to meet you in person.
My pleasure, Scout. I look forward to meeting you, too. And keep up your great work. I love what you do. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. This has been an absolute privilege. You're listening to Life Insights Live with Scout Bartlett, the special New Living Expo edition. And I want to remind you that treat yourself as a loved one, because you truly are. And that today, no matter where in the world you are, today is a perfect day for you to have a great day on purpose.